This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America on this edition of the program. 20 years ago this month, the United States invaded Iraq on the assumption that Saddam Hussein was building weapons of mass destruction. Another justification for the invasion, analysts say, was the purported link between Saddam Hussein's government and terrorist organizations, in particular, Al-Qaeda. When empirical evidence contradicted this premise, the then George W. Bush administration argued that Saddam's dictatorial rule warranted overthrowing in its own right and would pave the way for regime change that could, as columnist Max Boot says, quote, trigger a broader democratic transformation of the Middle East, unquote. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Former President George W. Bush, who launched the invasion in March 2003, was supposed to deliver shock and awe and topple a cruel regime which persecuted the minority Kurds and marginalized the majority Shia population. Instead, it produced a protracted and what many analysts say was a mismanaged military occupation of Iraq, spawned terrorism, and gave rise to the so-called Islamic State group, IS, and other disgruntled Iraqi Sunni groups who resented the democratically elected majority Shia government, mounted hundreds of counterattacks inside Iraq that destroyed civilian and religious infrastructure and cost tens of thousands of lives. In 2014, IS militants seized Mosul, Iraq's second largest city. Iran, which was strengthened, not weakened, by the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, deployed forces to fight IS in Iraq and helped Iraqi troops regain control of its territory. To date, more than 4,400 U.S. troops were killed and approximately 32,000 were wounded in the Iraq conflict. Iraq is a vastly different place today, but the negative and positive ramifications of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq reverberate to this day. To take stock of Iraq 20 years on, we turn to two distinguished Middle East analysts who are no strangers to the VOA microphones. Ellen Lapson is professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, a college based in nearby Virginia. Previously, she held senior national security positions in the U.S. government and served as CEO of the Stimson Center. And Rhonda Salim, she is director of the Conflict Resolution and Track 2 Dialogues Program at the Middle East Institute, and that's a policy group based in Washington. She is also a non-resident fellow at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies Foreign Policy Institute. Rhonda is the author of several studies, book chapters, and articles on conflict management, post-conflict peace building, and Middle East politics. And both panelists join me via Microsoft Teams. Ellen Lapson, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much, Carol. I'm glad to be with you.
And Rhonda Salim, it's a pleasure to host you as well. Well, Ellen Lapson, let me begin with you. What are the thoughts that come to your mind as a keen observer of Iraq on this, the 20th anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion?
So, Carol, I think we could begin with a snapshot of the present, which is a more positive than negative picture of how Iraqis have evolved in terms of building a more open and representative governance structure. They have lots of challenges, from internal politics to acute economic challenges, the unresolved issues of the Syrian civil war, the challenge of Iran, etc. But on balance, Iraq has restored its identity as a major player in the Middle East region. It has restored its foreign relations with its neighbors that shunned it for many years, both because of the nature of the Saddam Hussein regime, but also because of its over-reliance on the U.S. as the occupying power. But at the same time, I think we are in a moment of more somber reflection on really still looking for the larger meaning of why did the United States do what it did in 2003? And we can go into a little more detail later, but there's really a lot of churning, I think, in the national security intellectual community on re-examining the decisions themselves, as well as their very painful and costly consequences in the immediate aftermath of the U.S. invasion of 2003. In the opinion of some, we have still not reckoned with our own accountability for what was done to Iraq at the time, whether it was justified. And again, I hope we will look at the different concepts of what was truly the underlying motivation for the Bush administration. But that's just a broad brush opening.
Thank you, Ellen. And now turning to Rhonda, the same question to you, Rhonda. Where would you agree or disagree with Ellen with regard to where we are today and what were the motivations back in the George W. Bush administration, you know, for the invasion? What would you add to Ellen's reflections?
I agree with Ellen that Iraq today is in a better place than it was pre-2003 when it was suffering from heavy sanctions imposed at the time by the United States and other countries in the international community. However, Iraq is still dealing with the impact, with the long shadow of the war. The federal structure that was put in place by the 2005 Constitution is really not fulfilled as a political order of Iraq. They have the impact of the ISIS war with the popular mobilization forces, these militias that were put together in response to a fatwa by the Shiite cleric Sistani to fight ISIS in 2014 when it was on the doorsteps of Baghdad. These are now major power players in Iraq, and often, while they are supposed to be integrated under the prime minister's office and be part of the Iraqi security services, they often operate outside the writ of the government and have their own agendas, often exhibiting more loyalty to Iranian national interest than it is to Iraqi national interest. In terms of resuming its place in the Arab world, I think Iraq definitely today is better in terms of its relations with its Arab neighborhood than was the case in 2006, even was the case in 2014 or even 2015-16. So we have seen Iraq trying to now, under the leadership of the previous prime minister, Mustafa al-Qadhimi, try to form this new Levant structure along with Egypt and Jordan. And we see better relations between Iraq and Arab Gulf countries, including the United Arab Emirates and definitely Saudi Arabia. Although the current government of Iraq, which is perceived in the Arab Gulf countries as being more pro-Iran than they would like to see, is still viewed with suspicion. I think, in my opinion, the most hopeful story from Iraq today is the youth story. It is the young kids who were behind the Tishreen Revolution, the 2019 October protest, who really, with that protest, put to an end the ethno-sectarian divides that brought the country in 2005-2006 into a civil war. We see now Iraq have moved away from the ethno-sectarian politics and more is looking at building a national identity. But also that depends on how they can navigate going forward the relationship between Baghdad and Erbil. I think this is a everlasting problem in terms of establishing better underpinnings for this relationship, sustained underpinnings for this relationship, whether it is the budget law, whether it's the oil law, whether it's the role of the Peshmerga. So that remains a problem, and that remains an obstacle to really Iraq getting to play a regional role the way it should be, partly because it's still reeling from a lot of domestic issues. And a country that has a lot of domestic issues, domestic divides, is going to be unable to play the kind of regional role, mediator between Iran and the U.S. that Iraq has striven to. But definitely there is more hope in the context of ongoing sustained issues, again, like this relationship between Baghdad and Erbil, that continuously is in turmoil and unstable.
You both make some very excellent points, which we'll pick up on. Back to you, Ellen Lapson. Both of you said that today Iraq has, in a sense, restored its stature in the Arab world. It has relations with its neighbors and is now a major player. Rhonda Salim mentioned the youth story, the so-called Tishreen Revolution in 2019, fighting against the sectarian divides among the different groups, Shia, Sunni, and Kurdish, but also fighting what is seen as endemic corruption. But let's go back to maybe one of the obstacles or challenges, and that would be, let's say, Iraqi relations with Iran or Iran's influence, which in effect the Bush administration helped to promote by virtue of this invasion, something that they probably would like to have avoided. But nonetheless, Iran has much more influence now as a result of the U.S.-led invasion. What about Iran's influence, its relationship with the popular mobilization forces, the Shia militias that Rhonda mentioned? How is that problematic in your view?
So I think what we saw in the most recent government formation is that within the Shia political spectrum in Iraq, there's a lot of Shia political parties that do not want to be seen as clients of Iran in any way. So I really agree with Rhonda that let's hope that Iraq is reaching a kind of post-sectarian new political equilibrium where, first of all, the Sunni-Shia divide is less front of mind among Iraqis. We see both at the personal social level, but also at the political level, some greater capacity to put sectarianism aside and find out whether there are other shared purposes and shared objectives. And that includes whether Shia political parties want to distance themselves from Iran. The reality is Iran will always be Iraq's biggest neighbor. There will be cultural and religious imperatives that people flow back and forth for the religious reasons, pilgrimage. You know, Iran will probably remain the largest trading partner. But meanwhile, Iran is quite preoccupied with its own internal issues. Iran has had this also popular revolt led by young women and girls. So it may be that Iran is also a little bit less focused on trying to meddle or manipulate Iraqi politics. However, I think Iran will look after its own interests in Iraq and will always have agents of influence, whether they are formal political parties or in a more informal, individualized network of people who are pro-Iran inside the system of Iraq. So I think that's just an open-ended reality. But I wanted to just go back to Rhonda's youth point, because I think both in Iran and in Iraq, you know, on the one hand, it's inspiring to see young people step up and get politically active and say, we want to make our country a better place. In the case of Iraq, it was borderline destabilizing when people were so angry at the government a couple of summers back for not being able to provide enough electricity and 120 degree heat, etc. So we do have to worry that youth can also get very frustrated and exasperated that the government's capacity to provide basic services may still be limited. And so you certainly have to hope that this energy of the younger generation will get channeled in productive ways and that they won't become radicalized. So the state of Iraq still has a lot of improving to do to provide basic services to its citizens. Young people being mobilized is on balance a positive thing, but it has also looked a little bit shaky at times of whether their defiance of the order, that can turn into something closer to an internal source of instability. Let's hope that's not the case.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first you are listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Ellen Lapson, professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, from whom you just heard, and Rhonda Salim. She's director of the Conflict Resolution and Track 2 Dialogues Program at the Middle East Institute, a policy group based in Washington. We're reflecting on the 20th anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq and its impact on the broader region. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Here's a shout out to a new Twitter follower from Turkey, Ushin Elichin. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com. or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. We're turning to you, Rhonda Salim, to continue our conversation. You mentioned the relationship between Baghdad and Erbil, so referring to northern Iraq, the Kurdish region. Would you elaborate a bit on how you see this dilemma, and do you see some type of convergence of interests going forward?
This has been an everlasting issue. And I think part of the problem lies in the fact that in the 2005 Constitution, and not acting on the clauses of the Constitution, especially when it comes to the oil law. And part of it is also personality. Remember, this relationship, if I were to put a starting point for the current challenges, I would go back all the way to Nouri al-Maliki when he was prime minister between 2006 to 2014. I mean, he definitely was against the implementation of the oil law. He was against the implementation of the clause having to do with the final status of territories like Kirkuk, which the KRG, the Kurdistan Regional Government, would like to see it as under their control. And for him coming into power, weakening the Kurds and weakening the Kurdish influence in the decision-making process in Baghdad was one of his means of consolidating what he calls Shia power over Baghdad and over decision-making in Iraq, but also his own power. And that has been part of his strategy throughout the period of being a prime minister. The other strategies he worked on to consolidate Shia power, I think one is to marginalize at the time moderate Sunni leaders and try to basically label them as terrorists, whatever. And third, to walk away from the program that was put in place by the Surge in 2007 when they created the Sons of Iraq. And that was a Sunni movement that worked with the American, opposed to Al-Qaeda at the time. And part of the promise that the Americans gave them is that they will be given jobs in the official security structure and salaries. And he walked away from that. And in my opinion, that was part of the membership that went eventually into ISIS in 2014. And so that relationship since then has not been resolved. And you had had successive governments in Baghdad under different prime ministership. With some, it was better because of personality, like with Adel Abdel Mahdi. The personal relationship between him and the leadership in KRG was very good. And so you saw some of those tensions get de-escalated and maybe a framework was put in place to move toward a solution. The same thing with Mustafa al-Qadhimi, the previous prime minister. The problem is that you don't have a constituency in Baghdad, both among Shia and among Sunni, who are pushing and lobbying hard for this relationship to be renegotiated on a better basis. In fact, for the Arab Sunnis, going for minimizing Kurdish influence in Iraq is part of their Arab nationalist agenda. And for the Shia, the argument for many of the Shia leaders, the Kurds have gotten too much power and the leadership or the political power in Baghdad really should reside with the Shia, and hence the political power for the Kurds need to be minimized. That's the real problem, is that you have the legal framework to negotiate these differences, but the political will, especially on the Arab Shia and the Arab Sunni side in Baghdad, has not been present, especially since the demise of President Talabani, who really was a good mediator in that relationship. And if he were to remain on the scene, I think that relationship would have been put on a better working basis. But we are where we are, and the challenges continue.
No question about it. Sectarianism, particularly Arab versus Kurdish, as you said, Rhonda, is still an issue, notwithstanding many of the sectarian divides have diminished. Ellen Lapson, you may wish to comment on that. If not, I would like also to ask you to characterize U.S.-Iraqi relations today.
So quickly, a comment to just add to Rhonda's very brilliant and deep understanding of the Iraqi Kurdish problem. Let's just remind ourselves that Kurds today are a source of friction in the national politics of Turkey and Syria as well. And so this is an unresolved statehood question or self-determination problem, if you will, not unlike the Palestinians. So it festers and it plays out a little bit differently in each of the three countries, but certainly for Turkey, for a temporarily divided Syria, and for Iraq's uneasy federalism, the status of Kurds is a region-wide challenge, I think. And we don't hear as much these days about Kurdish demand for independence, but that always hovers beneath the surface, not unlike in Taiwan or other places that are unfulfilled sovereignties, if you will. So on U.S.-Iraq relations, I do think the Iraqis have been coming to town. The Biden administration has dusted off the old framework for cooperation between the two countries that had certainly gone dormant in the Trump administration. So I do think there's a slight re-energizing and revalidation of bilateral cooperation in a whole bunch of areas, but certainly energy is important. Education, restoring educational exchanges, security cooperation is huge. We always have missions in Baghdad still working with the Iraqi National Armed Forces and law enforcement community. So I think that is a reasonably productive endeavor. In the most recent visit by the Iraqi prime minister, one issue that that is problematic is the Iraqis' request from the U.S. sanctions relief because of their energy interdependence with Iran. And I believe there may also be a question of sanctions relief from trade with Russia. So the Iraqis are asking the U.S. government, we have to pay our bills to these two providers, Iran and Russia. Can you please give us a waiver? And I think the Biden administration has not given them the answer they had hoped for. But overall, I would say there is an uptick in the energy and activity in the bilateral relationship.
Rhonda Sleem, an uptick in the energy and bilateral relationship between the United States and Iraq today under the Biden administration. How would you characterize it?
Yeah, I tend to agree with Ellen. And I think we have seen under the Biden administration a shift from how we used to look at Iraq. I mean, the policy lenses through which we always dealt with Iraq, which is the fight against ISIS and Iran, especially during the Trump administration, maximum pressure on Iran. I think we are now moving away to thinking about a relationship between two countries that have a number of pillars. You know, part of it is definitely the security assistance we are providing, but part of it is energy, part of it is climate, part of it is banking reform. Then we have more advantage than Iran. We need to play a long game with Iraq. And in the long game, when we focus on arenas that Iran cannot help Iraq with, I mean, Iran cannot help with banking reform. Iraq cannot help with technological innovation. Iran cannot help with the issues that the youth are looking for. And that we have an advantage. And the more we shift our bilateral relationship from a focus purely on security and ISIS, arenas where Iran can have an advantage, to arenas where we have an advantage, I think the relationship between the two countries will improve, but also will deepen, not only between government to government, but also between people to people.
So as we close, Ellen Lapson, back to the original question with regard to the reasons for or justifications given for the invasion of Iraq back in 2003. How is the debate seen today, 20 years later?
So it's very interesting to listen to some people who take a historical perspective. Melvin Loeffler, a very distinguished emeritus professor at the University of Virginia, has now come out with a new book arguing that, first of all, Bush was in charge. He was not being manipulated by his advisors, and that his primary motivation was fear and the strong desire to prevent another 9/11. How that got transferred onto Iraq is obviously, there's a lot of analytic flaws and incorrect assumptions, et cetera. That's one interpretation. But we know that in the public discourse, and I would still hold the Bush administration responsible for making arguments to the public to win support for what they were about to do. You can't take away that it was about the freedom agenda. There had been success of democratization in Eastern Europe, and there was a belief that somehow the Middle East, if we could just peel off, remove the worst of the dictators, that somehow there'd be this rush towards democratic culture in the Middle East. And the WMD question, where we didn't want to believe the answers that the UN was giving us, that these programs were dormant, that there really wasn't any active production of weapons of mass destruction. So I don't give them a pass on trying to make both the democracy and the WMD argument. My colleague Ahsen Butt has written to me what might be a very compelling way to think about this, which is that 9/11 truly was the trauma. It truly was the organizing motivation for everybody in the Bush team, whether you were a neocon ideologue or something else, but that it was an instinctive desire to demonstrate that the United States still had dominant power, that we could deter and intimidate any other actor from "don't you dare do what Al-Qaeda did." And so it was this desire to kind of reassert American hegemony. The irony and the tragedy of it all is that by doing so, we actually brought an end to the period of the single superpower, that the Iraq War had such tragic consequences that it really was an end of an era of American supremacy, not the continuation of it.
Rhonda Sleem, go ahead.
Yeah, but the freedom agenda came after the UN failed to find WMD. It was a spin in order to justify a war that cost eventually trillions and hundreds of thousands of deaths, especially on the Iraqi side. And so I don't have a say on, you know, which of these theories really is what compelled Bush. But I tend to believe at least the narrative that Alan just talked about, that he was in charge. The president was in charge and he was not manipulated by his advisors, as some of the talk at the time, that it was mostly Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld who were pushing Bush into the war in Iraq.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Ellen Lapson, professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, and Rhonda Salim, director of the Conflict Resolution and Track 2 Dialogues Program at the Middle East Institute. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Please join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.